Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. The date is February 17th, 2013. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. And joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And welcome Catherine Smith.
Hello, good evening.
Yeah, good to have you, Catherine. Tonight, we've got a big show. We've got Tom Jensen from Public Policy Polling once again. He's got a bunch of new polls, and we're going to discuss a lot of those with him when he comes on. Also, he's got a Georgia poll he's been taking questions or possible suggestions on a few days ago, and that usually means he's put it in the field, so we're going to try to see if he'll talk a little Georgia with us, including North Carolina, Louisiana, and some national stuff he's done. In particular, Hillary Clinton is playing very well in traditionally red states, and so we may discuss that with them too. But until then, we're going to discuss different topics of local and national interest and international interest, and we're going to start off internationally tonight, and that would be for the first time in just about 600 years, the Pope is leaving the papacy, I would say office, but I don't know if that's the appropriate term. He's leaving his post instead of, serving to death, which is what's happened for the past six centuries. And this is, it's not unprecedented, but it's certainly the first time anybody in, the New World has seen it, we could say, since this is pre-Columbus, the last time it happened. Guys, I'll tell you what, this got some play, if you will, but I don't think it's gotten the attention that you would think it would, given it's the first time in nearly, half a millennium, if you will. Tim, are you surprised that it's not getting more coverage?
Yeah, a little bit. And I got a feeling that it's getting a lot more coverage overseas, perhaps, than it is here. I think the word is abdicate. That's the correct word. It is technically like, a head of state. The guy's a head of state, really, like a monarch. His is a political as well as a religious position. And so what happens there is very important. As many Catholics as there are in the world and how influential they are around the world. So I'm a little surprised it's not getting more play. Maybe it'll get a little more as the event unfolds in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, it couldn't get, you think you'd get more. We've had more coverage of the cruise ship, if you will. And I know, and I'm a Protestant. I mean, pretty much all my family's Protestants, if you will. Most of the people that I work with Protestants, so it's not like I can say, oh well, if you're Catholic it's a much bigger deal, and I'm sure it is, but I'm a Protestant saying, hey, why is it getting more coverage? I mean, I get the idea of who the Pope is in our society today and who throughout the past 2000 or 1500 years, whenever was it Constantine, the Roman emperor that brought Rome to Christianity. I mean, since he, did that, what a big role that plays. Catherine, are you surprised it's not getting more attention?
I'm a little bit surprised, but what are you going to say? I mean, what is there really to say? He's abdicating and we have to get a new pope. I think Tim's right. I think there will be a lot more conversation about it and coverage of it when they start to look at who's going to be the next pope, because I think it could be a real shocker, because it looks like there's a African bishop or cardinal who may be in line, and that will be a big surprise if we have a black-skinned pope.
Now, I guess in this, you know, this context, you would say African. That would be correct, because if they're
he is African. He's from Africa.
And in the world, yeah, and in the world sense, that's what it would be, which that would be interesting because of a lot of African countries, some of them tilt more towards Islam. If an African were the pope, you think that maybe Catholicism might rebound, if you will, in the continent of Africa. So there are, I mean, there are some things to discuss. Now, there's a lot, I guess, more religious implication than political. But now, one thing I thought about, and we were talking about pre-show, how it may be that the pope, his health is so bad that he's not really going to, we're not really going to see much of him however long he lives. But let's say, you know, he were to recover somewhat and he could still be somewhat around, if you will. Now, he may completely respect the new pope and not say anything at all. But what if he were to, you know, take a different position on some issue than the current pope? What would that mean? I don't think that would happen.
You're not going to hear from him
could.
Like that.
I mean, this is a media world. I mean, there's never been a situation like this where there's media and, you know, this is an era of television, internet, the printing press practically.
I just go against what he's saying publicly now, which is that he's going to retire quietly.
Yeah, I mean, they're renovating a big convent on the Vatican property for his retirement. An old convent, converted convent. I just can't imagine that there would be, I mean, it's sort of the last bastion of rules and pomp and circumstance. I can't imagine that he would do anything that would be controversial after he abdicates. I think it would be. Yeah, I just don't see it. But, I mean, I Lord knows I'm wrong a lot, but it would be a big surprise to me.
And David, you said a lot. You said a lot of people are not, you know, tuning in and watching it, and it's not getting a lot of coverage now. But I would wager strongly that world leaders are keeping a very, very close eye on what goes on over there with this and how it plays out and who is selected for rather obvious reasons, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, but you would think there would be more talk about it. I mean, I can't keep getting back to that. I mean, you look at some of the issues, and we'll speak on some of them that got more coverage. I mean, I said the cruise ship, and the cruise ship thing really is not a topic that we would discuss on our show. But that got a lot of attention. You get the idea if the Pope would have said, "Hey, I'm retiring," in the middle of the speech, you would have drunk a glass of water. That would have gotten more attention than the fact that he's retiring, and it hadn't happened in 600 years.
I'm still thinking that every network, as February 28th approaches in this country, all the print media, everyone is going to send somebody over there, and you're going to start seeing stories about it daily as it unfolds. I think it's really going to be saturating the news media to the point people will be a little sick of looking at it.
Waiting for the white smoke. We're going to be waiting for the little white smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I remember when I was a kid, I guess it would have been around 1980, one side or the other, seeing that it was like a TV thing. I mean, the TV news actually stopped and covered it. Now, of course, now with network news, you can, you know, leave that to CNN and MSNBC and Fox. You know, should they decide to pull away from people drinking water and cruise ships, if you will. Or, of course, I guess this African runner, that's going to get a lot of attention. Now, of course, I kind of get why that's more interesting than, say, somebody drinking water.
Because people it's human to be, should I use the word, titillated by scandal. That's about what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
People love a good scandal. especially in this country. So obviously, the what went on in South Africa is going to get a lot of play here as people try to devour all the salacious inside details. People love that sort of thing. And the media understands that, and the word ratings, you know.
Yeah. No, exactly what you mean. Well, let's go ahead and start into another topic, and I guess I've already alluded to it, and that would be Marco Rubio. Well, the State of the Union in general, I mean, one thing, the State of the Union really didn't get a lot of attention either. You know, yeah, the president gave a speech. We knew ahead of time Ted Nugent attended it. That got some attention. And then in the response, Marco Rubio drank some water. And what he said really didn't get any attention either. And a topic we talked about last week, Rand Paul, his Tea Party response really didn't get any play. It seemed like the whole event itself was surrounding the fact that Marco Rubio needed to stop in the middle of the speech and drink some water, and now he may not be a good nominee for the Republicans in 2016. I mean, where does this view or this short-sighted thing come from, Catherine?
I don't know. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I did see the, you know, clip of him reaching for the water, and I don't know why it was so captivating, but for whatever reason it was, I found it odd that he had to reach over so far to get a glass of water when he's standing in a podium, but that's just, you know, whoever set it up's problem. I don't know. I mean, I thought it was funny, but I didn't see how it became such a big deal. I think the content of what he said was more interesting than it wasn't really a response. It was just, here's what I want you to hear me say today.
Yeah, and to me, I mean, part of that, just the device of it, you almost have to just kind of have something planned, whatever you think. Tim, what's your take on how much has been made of the water?
Well, I'll give a quick response because it looks like our guest is about to join us. But I cringed when Rubio reached for that water. I felt his pain. I've done a lot of public speaking. You can get away with that if a television camera is not on you, but you've just got to be spot on with a TV camera on you, because that's all that will be remembered about his remarks and nothing else. Saturday Night Live. Reminded us, right?
And that's what Saturday Night Live is supposed to do, but then a lot of other sources are supposed to be more serious. That's all they thought about, too. And while I'm no big fan of Marco Rubio's policies, I don't think that should define whether or not he's a candidate for current or future office. Well, welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show for many times now from Public Policy Poll and Tom Jensen.
Hey, it's good to be with you all.
Good to have you back. Well, Tom, first thing we got to ask, since we're all in Georgia, we saw that you were taking suggestions on Georgia and Montana polls. I think I even sent in a suggestion or two. Have you put that poll in the field yet?
Yeah, we don't have any final results yet, but just some preliminary things we've sort of seen are that it really looks like the Georgia Senate seat could be pretty competitive in the general election. We tested a bunch of different possible matchups for that Senate election next year, and so far all of them are running pretty close.
Yeah, so names, I guess you're still going to do a little more work on that. Were there any names that surprised you in either party?
No, I think really the big key is just that all of these Republicans who are looking at running or have already announced really aren't folks who are particularly well-known sort of to the public at large yet. You know, certainly political junkies know the Paul Browns and Tom Prices of the world, but obviously just representing a small chunk of the state for each of them in their congressional districts, there's really not a whole lot of statewide name recognition for any of them, and I think that's a big part of why things look so competitive at this point.
Yes. Well, I would assume in addition to the Senate race, you looked at the governor's race. Numbers that have come out in both in your polls and other polls have shown Nathan Deal in pretty good shape, but then in this state, every county, it seems like, in Georgia continues to take education funding hits. And so I'm wondering if that's had any effect on not only Nathan Deal, but the Republican leadership in general in Georgia.
Yeah, Governor Deal's approval ratings in our polls really are not that great, and that continues to be the case with our poll this month. I mean, I certainly think he's at least a modest favorite for reelection, but I think that's a race that's a bit of a sleeper that could maybe be close than people expect. We find Governor Deal's approval rating in the 30s, which is, I think, certainly below where he would like it to be.
Yes. Well, I guess we'll ask one final question on Georgia since it's not all the way finished. When should our listeners look to see the results tweeted out, posted on your site, what have you?
We'll have the Georgia Senate poll out on Tuesday, and then probably the other components of the Georgia poll out on Wednesday.
Well, that'll give us something to look forward to in midweek. Well, we know you've been doing some other work, and I don't want to ask all the questions. I'm going to pass it to Tim to ask about maybe some national stuff, and then Catherine will ask about something, and then we'll discuss some of these other southern polls you've done.
Okay, sounds great.
Good evening once again, Tom, and I got to talk a little inside baseball with you right quick before I get into the political stuff. I know you keep talking about the Big Blue punching a ticket to the Final Four, but, buddy, you better watch those Spartans. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think the Tar Heels are going to be going to the Final Four this year, but certainly we would we'd be happy with about anything they did beyond just making it to the tournaments, just one of those years.
Yeah, well, they'll probably do better at getting in the tournament than Kentucky will do. So I wanted to jump way up, if I could, to the state of Alaska. You've been doing a lot of polling there on the national race and on the Alaska Senate race. And I know that you put Sarah Palin, she was included in the model, and I couldn't help but notice that she just did not do well in either model at all. Is she done as far as electability?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's no way Governor Palin could run a successful campaign for just about anything at this point. But what's interesting is just how particularly unpopular she is in her home state. I don't think people really appreciate it if you're the governor and you signed up for a four-year term and then you'd rather go be on a reality show than actually do that job that the people elected you to. So certainly, I mean, we know that Sarah Palin is quite unpopular nationally, but it's interesting to see that her numbers in Alaska are even worse than they are other places. Maybe the thing in that poll that struck me the most was that in a hypothetical presidential contest between Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton would be up by 16 points in Alaska. And certainly that says something about how popular Hillary Clinton is, but it also says a lot about how just really horrible Palin's standing is.
Mm. And on that national race, you of course, have been doing, I suppose, a robust amount of polling on the 2016 presidential race already, so much so, in fact, that some of our friends in the conservative blogosphere have indicated that you're actually conducting push polls for Hillary Clinton. But seriously, what can we learn about the 2016 race realistically 3 years out?
Well, I don't claim that the polls we're doing on 2016 at this point are really predictive. The reason that we're doing so much 2016 polling, even now here early in 2013, is just so that we can sort of build up a historical record over time of how things shifted. For instance, you all were talking about, Marco Rubio's gaffe or whatever you want to call it during his State of the Union response. We found Senator Rubio leading our national Republican polling for the last 3 months, and because we've been doing this polling every month, when we do our poll in March, we'll be able to see whether that really hurt him or not. That's really what we're doing it for more than anything else, is just to kind of see how these things shift over time. And it is, we're certainly not doing any push polling, but it is kind of interesting to look and see just how many states Hillary Clinton would be able to win, at least at this point in the game. we obviously know that she's a lot more well-known than a lot of the Republicans who were testing her against. But, you know, I think it's an interesting measure as she leaves the State Department just to see how strong that her standing really is.
Mm-hmm. And one final question, I'll throw it to Catherine. That standing, is Hillary Clinton presently the most popular political person in America?
Yeah, I would definitely say so in our poll, and she's certainly a lot more popular than the president or the vice president or certainly anybody on the Republican side. The only person who might give her a little bit of a run for her money is Chris Christie. But the interesting thing about Chris Christie is that even though he has an unusual amount of crossover appeal for Republicans to Democrats and independents, Republicans themselves actually aren't as enthusiastic about him as they are about a lot of other Republicans. Some of his speaking out has not played very well with the party base.
All right. And on that note, we'll throw it to Catherine. Catherine?
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you, I was surprised by the Landrieu numbers and also
sure.
by just sort of in general by some of the things you discovered in your polls in Louisiana. So do you have any understanding of or explanation or do you understand why? I just was surprised because we all think of Bobby Jindal as being sort of a popular Republican, but apparently I haven't been looking at the polls very closely because he doesn't look very popular. And do we have a sense of why that is?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's kind of interesting. We hadn't polled Louisiana in 2.5 years until last weekend. And when we had polled in 2010, Governor Jindal was one of the most popular governors in the country. Now we find that he's one of the least popular governors in the country. One reason his numbers had been a little bit inflated was that he really got bipartisan applause for how he handled the oil spill in Louisiana back in 2010. So part of the reason his numbers have gone down was kind of a natural reduction just because they were maybe a little inflated in 2010 because of that. But I think that what you're seeing happen to Jindal's approval numbers is a little bit similar to why you've seen Sarah Palin become so unpopular. Certainly Jindal has remained in office as governor, but I think it's obvious to a lot of people that he very much has a national focus right now, spending a lot of time speaking out on national things, traveling, that sort of stuff, doing things that maybe aren't that relevant to his actual job as governor, and I think a lot of the time voters just kind of resent it if you go national while you're supposed to be doing a job on the home front. Another thing I think that's interesting to look at with Governor Jindal is he's kind of been talking tough to his own party. You know, some people have sort of distilled it into Bobby Jindal's told Republicans they have to stop being stupid. It's not my words, it's things I've seen other people saying. And I think that maybe a lot of Republicans don't appreciate that, the really Tea Party segments of the Republican electorate. One thing that was particularly interesting in these Jindal numbers is that even his numbers with Republicans are way down from what they used to be. He used to be over 80% approval of Republicans. Now he's down to the 50s. And we actually tested him, since he does seem to be interested in running for president in 2016. We tested him, and he'd only finished third in a Republican primary in his own state. He finished behind both Marco Rubio and Mike Huckabee when we polled that. So he definitely has some work to do to sort of get his image back up.
And then what about the rest of the Republicans and the rest of the outlook in Louisiana? I mean, does this look like it might be a good place for, I mean, I know their Democratic Party is revitalized, so they might be in a good situation to pick up some power.
Sure. Well, I think a lot of national pundits, experts, what have you, have kind of been operating under the impression that Mary Landrieu would just be, you know, pretty much dead on arrival when it comes to her reelection chances. And what we found on this poll is that she is maybe more popular than you would expect. She has a positive approval rating. It's pretty closely divided, but she's up a net 16 points from August of 2010 when we had last polled the state. And I think that her numbers in 2010 really were kind of deflated because of Obamacare and it being unpopular, but I think that's really faded from a lot of people's minds. It's not what they're thinking about anymore, and certainly the Landrieu name has been a very powerful one in Louisiana for a long time. And, of course, one thing that you all know is that Louisiana was one of the few states in the country where President Obama actually did better in 2012 than he did in 2008. I think part of that is some folks who were displaced by Katrina, who are Democratic-leaning voters, are now back in the state and voting. I think that helped President Obama do a little bit better this time around. But also, I think you're just seeing some Democratic trend in the state in general. So anyway, we find Senator Landrieu leading every Republican we tested against her. Certainly, in some of those cases, I think it's a situation where the Republicans don't have a lot of name recognition, and that helps her do a little bit better. But, you know, I think at worst this race is going to be a toss-up next year, whereas I think a lot of, you know, quote-unquote experts were probably ready to just put it in the Republican column a couple months ago.
Right. So that's good news for those of us on the left. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to pass it back to David now.
Thank you.
Yeah, according to the Louisiana poll, and I guess it would be a toss-up unless the Republican nominee was Roger Goodell or David Duke, because they didn't fare quite as well in your polling. Well, I want to move back a little bit national, I guess you could say Nebraska. Chuck Hagel's nomination was rejected, and I know y'all might not have specifically polled on this, but the fact that he was put down by his own party seems a little crazy to me. Have you read any polling, Tom, that shows how voters in general feel about this, and then Republican voters with the president, you know, this being a move towards, I guess, a little more bipartisanship in his cabinet, and the Republicans reject it?
Yeah, what we have found, we did a national poll about Hagel a couple weeks ago, and what we found was about 38% of voters thought he should be confirmed, about 32% of voters were opposed to confirming him, and 30% didn't have an opinion one way or the other. That may seem a little bit high, but stuff like this, you know, cabinet approvals or cabinet picks, it's really stuff that only – you know, insider political junkies like us are paying a ton of attention to. But there was a huge partisan divide on Hagel's nomination, and it sort of reflects the dialogue that you're seeing. Almost all Democrats who had an opinion about Hagel thought he should be confirmed. Almost all Republicans who had an opinion about Hagel thought he should not be confirmed. So he definitely has become very polarizing along party lines, to the point where you see this thing where I don't think anybody would have expected 5 years ago, where Democrats are much, much, much more supportive of Mr. Hagel than Republicans are.
Yeah, I mean, that's just interesting. I remember around 2002, 2004, Zell Miller put out a book called National Party No More, and one of the things he said in that book was that when George Bush appointed a nominee, that the people would have to live with it because he won, and they ought to get confirmed. And you'd think that some Republicans, since Zell Miller seems to support them more than he does Democrats now, would follow his advice, but not so. Well, let's continue to move through these things. And let's talk about North Carolina, your home state. You did a poll, did some numbers on Kay Hagan and your new governor up there, McCrory. What did you find in North Carolina poll?
Well, we continue to find Senator Hagan leading all of her potential Republican opponents for reelection. Her approval rating's not that high. It's only 39%, but I really think Republicans have a problem here in trying to get a strong candidate. They don't have anybody who really stands out as somebody who would be that good. So we find Senator Hagan with anywhere from a 5 to 15-point lead right now against 7 or 8 different Republicans that we tested her against. I still think she's certainly vulnerable because of the lower approval numbers, but Republicans really have some work to do to get someone good into that race. Governor McCrory, after a month in office, has seen his net approval cut in half. In January, he was at a plus 26 approval spread. Now he's down to plus 14. He's done a fair amount of stuff in his first month in office that isn't very popular. One thing particularly unpopular, he gave his cabinet big raises. We find over 80% of voters in the state opposed to that. Governor McCrory also made some comments about higher education in the state that many backers of the school's major public universities, UNC, NC State, et cetera, thought were somewhat insulting, really kind of put his foot in his mouth on that one. The legislature's been trying to make big cuts to unemployment that a lot of voters aren't really down with. So, you know, Governor McCrory certainly still has a positive approval rating, but a lot of Democrats who in his first month in office were kind of taking a wait-and-see approach, willing to give him a chance, now after a month of the McCrory administration are saying, yeah, we don't like this guy.
Yeah, I guess it's what they thought they would get, and they've kind of the honeymoon period wore off. Funny that you mentioned the Republicans can't find anybody good to run against Kay Hagan, a movie that came out this summer was about the state of North Carolina. There, the Republicans couldn't find anybody good to run against Will Ferrell's character, and they found some Marty fellow that I don't think anybody would describe as a good candidate. And I guess reality imitates art there.
I think they can do a little better than Zach Galifianakis, but maybe not that much better.
Well, one would hope. And I've worked in dozens of races in North Carolina, and I find the Democrats and Republicans to be of better quality in North Carolina than certainly that character, and probably a lot of states throughout the South, and for that matter. One more state that you polled recently, it was right at the very end of the month of January, but we hadn't had any on since then, is Texas. And there was a new group called Battleground Texas that's come up to try to turn Texas into a battleground state by hopefully 2016, but then certainly after that. You found that Hillary Clinton could do well in Texas, just like she could do well in Alaska. Hopefully she'd do a little bit better in Arkansas since she was first lady for there for a decade. But speaking of Texas, even if Hillary Clinton wasn't the nominee, could Texas turn as fast as, you know, 4 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly seeing a situation where we're getting closer and closer to less than half of the electorate in Texas being white, and certainly when you see 97% of African Americans voting Democratic and over 70% of Latinos voting Democratic, the demographics that are growing in Texas are the demographics that favor Democrats. So I think that there's a pretty good chance that if the Democrats have the right candidate in 2016, Texas could finally be competitive. If Rick Perry's the Republican candidate for governor again next year, Texas could be competitive next year in the governor's race because Governor Perry is so unpopular. So, I mean, my guess is that it's probably going to be another 10 years or so unless Hillary Clinton runs in 2016 before Democrats can really turn Texas into a swing state. But I definitely think that is the direction you'll be going in. I think as even the battleground Texas people acknowledge, it's probably just going to take a little time.
Yes. Well, before I ask you a final question, Catherine, Tim, any more questions for Tom?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Go ahead, Tim.
I most certainly do. Tom, the Democrats next year are going to be defending 23 of the 33 Senate seats that are up. Does the GOP have a chance to gain control of the U.S. Senate next year?
I think the Republicans do have a chance, but it really depends on them basically winning every single one of these red state Democrat seats. So it means that, you know, even though Kay Hagan's up in the polls now, she'd have to lose. Even though Mary Landrieu's up in the polls now, she'd have to lose. Somebody like Max Baucus in Montana, he would have to lose in South Dakota, have to lose in Arkansas, have to lose in West Virginia. And then that's assuming that the Republicans don't make any mistakes anywhere else. Of course, we know that they've lost some seats they should have easily won in states like Missouri and Indiana last cycle. And you could see a similar situation to that somewhere like Georgia, somewhere like Kentucky, where if you run the candidate, you could really put yourself into a hole. So definitely the layout of the seats is such that Republicans ought to make some gains, maybe even substantial gains, but that was certainly the case in 2012 as well, and that's not really how it went.
Oh, that's true. So we would have to look at a 2010 model for it to be pulled off, right?
Yeah, 2010 and then some, because even in 2010, Republicans lost a fair number of seats they should have won by nominating the wrong candidate. They really need to try to stay away from doing that again.
Yeah. And one more quick question, and then I'm going to be done, because it is 2013, and with New Jersey obviously a one-sided race, will Virginia be the center of the polling universe for this year?
Yeah, I think so. Certainly the New Jersey governor's race is not nearly as competitive as we might have expected it to be 6 months ago. Certainly looks like a blowout right now. So I think that that Cuccinelli-McAuliffe race is really looking like a toss-up when you kind of look at all the polling together. And I'm sure that's somewhere that we'll be doing many, many, many polls over the course of this year.
And I shall look forward with relish to reading yours. And that does me, David.
Okay, well, Tom, I've learned that one of the best questions we can always ask you at the end is, do you have any other findings we hadn't asked about that are just so interesting that you want to share them?
Well, we'll also have this Montana poll this week, and, you know, as you would expect in the state that that Mitt Romney won by over 10 points, it looks like that Senate race is going to be pretty competitive next year. Max Baucus running for re-election is not a very popular guy. If Brian Schweitzer wanted to run against Baucus in a primary, Schweitzer would beat Baucus by quite a substantial margin. That's going to be kind of interesting to keep an eye on.
Okay. Well, Tom, thanks again. And we're going to be looking Tuesday and Wednesday at when you pull out that or release the Georgia and Montana polls.
Okay. I appreciate it. Always good to talk to you all.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, sir.
Care. Bye.
Tom Jensen of Public Policy Polling, always bringing us great numbers and all the work he does. And the fact that he also keeps up with other polling, I mean, he really gives you a picture. And, like, the numbers he talked about from Louisiana, I guess the book that we, Tim, I know you and I and Kathy, you may have read it too, last year that talked about how demographic shifts after the 2008 election switched states trended more and less Democratic. They hadn't had a 2012 counterpart, so I didn't really realize that Louisiana had actually moved more towards our column, unlike a lot of other states. So good information there.
Catherine obviously did realize it. That's why she asked the question. Good job there, Catherine.
and that is going to be a key one, that Mary Landrieu defending her seat, and the fact that the Landrieu name is just so popular. Affects things, because obviously Mitch Landrieu, mayor of New Orleans, he could actually move up a level to statewide office and possibly, you know, win a seat.
Well, the other thing,
a race for the Democrats.
The other important thing about that is that, you know, I think we all sort of, you know, everyone on the left or all Democrats sort of have feared Bobby Jindal because we thought he was their next, you know, sort of, you know, prodigy. But apparently they don't like him very much. So that was the other good sign in there, I thought.
Yeah. You know, he's been around a long time. I mean, other than Rick Perry, I get the idea that he's been, you know, kind of maybe the longest-serving governor in America. And sometimes I think people just get sick of people. Because then everything that goes wrong, you know, that guy's been around forever. And they get blamed for it. And we can say rightly or wrongly in some of these cases. So there's probably some voter fatigue there. Tim, you don't think so?
Well, I was just going to say perhaps his star has been eclipsed. Marco Rubio, Watergate and all, and Chris Christie, both, their stars are rising quickly to the top of that party. And I just think that Jindal's been replaced pretty much by these guys that are now recognized as the next generation of Republicans to challenge for national office. And he's just been knocked off the front page. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, he had his chance to do the State of the Union response, and people insulted his speech pattern, which still may have been you know, they said it was simplistic, like Sesame Street, which, I mean, that's probably more relevant than drinking water, but obviously if he had great ideas, which I don't know that, you know, trying to give everybody in town a school voucher, or I should say giving a select few a school voucher is the only plan for education is great thoughts, because that seems to be one of his major initiatives. But, you know, he had his chance, and he didn't take advantage of it. It was on the flavor of the month.
He's only been governor since 2008.
Why does it seem like he's been around since longer than that?
Well,
he would have won in 2007.
Yeah.
He was in the Louisiana House, and then he was I'm just looking at his Wikipedia, and he was Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation in HHS from 2001 to 2003. That was
maybe the Republican Party was pushing him longer. And that's right, he was in the House. And so he probably, that's why it seems like he's been governor. Yeah, I guess in my mind, since I'm not in Louisiana, I think, oh, well, ever since I've seen him, he's been governor or running for governor. And that part of that time he was in the House.
He
ran for governor, lost, and then he was in the House, and then he won governor. So I'm probably giving a link to his years of service that he doesn't deserve, I guess.
You know, though, you see Chris Christie and how he handled Sandy and how he worked with, you know, the president in another party, and then you see Marco Rubio taking the lead in a bipartisan manner on the immigration issue. What has Bobby Jindal done that would appeal to a broad swath of voters like those two have done? Can you think of anything?
He's younger. Yeah, he's younger. They probably like that. The fact that he is a man of color. It's not another old southern white guy, so it gives their party some diversity.
But
still, as far as what he's actually done, I agree. There's nothing
right
to hang your hat on.
And that's where he's failed.
Yeah. Well, guys, I'm going to kind of throw a little curve here, but if you've been searching anywhere on the Internet for the past 10, 15 minutes, and as I was, looking at things to formulate questions on public policy polling and others, everywhere I look on the Internet, I see an ad, top ad, sidebar ads, box ads that have just come up in the past few minutes for Paul Brown and his Senate campaign. He just launched a new website, I believe, while he's been on the show. In fact, unless one of y'all saw it before me, it looks like he is really trying to get out ahead of his opposition. And I will tell you this, Paul Brown, ever since he came around, has always, his website and his technology initiatives have always left a little bit to be desired. Not as tech savvy as his campaign might have been. But this is a much fresher, more polished look. Interesting to see that he's trying to work on this facet of his campaign early. Have y'all noticed this just in the past few minutes? And I mean, seriously, click anywhere on the internet and you'll see it.
David, I saw one a couple of days ago, a banner ad. I was just going across checking all the political sites, and there was a banner ad on Daily Coast, of all places, for Paul Brown. And I had to stop and look at it. It's got to be the same one. It's brand new.
Constitutional conservative?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even sure exactly what that means. I mean, I thought most people
that
served in either party, they supported the First Amendment, all that kind of thing. Although, honestly, from what I can tell is, the Republicans claim that, we want to, get rid of the Second Amendment, and then we say they don't defend the, say the 14th through 16th Amendments. And it's always kind of crazy that we use this Constitution as a weapon to defend ourselves or to attack the other party or what have you. But anyway, it looks like it's a more robust effort on his part. Catherine, have you seen him, and what do you think?
I haven't seen any of them. I must not be looking for the right things on the internet.
Yeah,
I always get things
know,
for
just
shoes and handbags and makeup. So.
Yeah, I don't know where I first. Maybe it was on public policy polling when I looked there and then got it, and then I clicked on it, and sometimes when you click on something, they assume you like it and you want to see more of it. And in this case, once was good.
Let me ask y'all something. I'm a little worried that this guy could actually get elected. Am I just speaking
for no
reason?
I keep saying that. People keep saying, the chair of the party, and other people keep saying, oh, yeah, bring us Paul Brown. I'm like, it depends on who we run against him, because I agree with you, Tim.
Uh-uh.
I mean, if he...
I don't want him.
We could, it's the same thing that happened back when Casey Cagle and Ralph Reed were running against each other. People were like, let's all vote Republican and vote for Ralph Reed, and then we'll – and I'm like, the only fear there is that they will actually get elected. You know, you but, no, I agree with you. I think he could easily get elected. In Georgia, if you've got an R next to your name and you're on the ballot.
Right. David,
yeah,
I noticed you.
But here,
you went. There you are. I've noticed you.
Yeah,
went
I'm here. I'm letting y'all talk. I mean, well, sometimes I run my mouth too much and I want to give you a chance. But I will tell you this. Now, here's my argument why I don't mind trying to choose the candidate that I think I can best defeat. Now, I'm not going to go and pick a Republican ballot to do it. I don't believe in that. But. I mean, okay, if you talk about that race between Ralph Reed and Casey Cagle, I'm sure the three of us might agree that Casey Cagle was the lesser of the two evils. Well, have we really enjoyed Casey Cagle's work that so much, that much? Really been that much better than Ralph Reed's would have been? And that's the thing. We could say, oh, yeah, we'll have an easier time beating Paul Brown, and we may have a little bit easier time beating Paul Brown than, say, Tom Price. But if Tom Price gets elected to the Senate, he's going to vote 97% of the same way that Paul Brown would vote.
But,
he just won't say as many crazy things.
But before you were born, in the 60s, Bo Calloway's supporters said the same thing in 1966. Let's all cross over.
By the way, that was not before I was born.
Okay. Not yeah, but anyway.
We're talking.
Bo Calloway supporters said the same thing. Let's all cross over and let's vote for Lester Maddox in the primary, and then we can beat him. But as you saw, Lester Maddox became the governor of Georgia and an utter embarrassment to this state. And that's the kind of thing Paul Brown could bring to that U.S. Senate seat. I mean, if he goes to making some of these crazy statements, it would serve to only bring embarrassment to this state. I can tolerate someone in the opposite party having different ideas from me and voting that way. But at least they can talk some sense when they're doing it. At least they're not going to bring embarrassment to my state when they do it. You know, talking craziness about, you know, science and stuff like that and saying it's lies from the pits of hell. And, you know, we just don't need somebody like that in the U.S. Senate. Are you following me, David?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's just I just don't think any of these Republicans are getting great shakes. And so I would like my best chance, but obviously the part that Democrats would need to focus on is who's our nominee, because if we run nobody or a nobody, our version of Marty off of the campaign, then we're not going to have a very good chance. And we've got to actually put a good candidate in this race and the governor's race, because I'll tell you what, and we can kind of get into another topic off of that, as an educator in Georgia and a parent, of two school-age students in Georgia, you know, the cuts in education are just getting drastic. And honestly, if you said, look, the Republicans are going to hold the two Senate seats, and one of them can be Paul Brown for the next 6 years each, but you'll win the governor's race, I'd take the governor's mansion, because the governor's mansion could then maybe restore some sanity to our state, because right now at the state government level, you know, we're just defunding education, and there's other, you know, areas we could say the same thing about. The Republicans are just wanting, whereas we can depend on senators from, you know, New York and California and Illinois, any other state that has Democratic senators to kind of right the American ship with the U.S. Senate, whereas in our state government, we have to have better leaders because we can't depend on other states. Would y'all be willing to make that bargain? Where we won the governor's mansion, but we lost the U.S. Senate seat.
To have Paul Brown in the Senate? No, I wouldn't make that deal.
And a Democrat is governor?
Yeah, I would not make that deal. I'm sorry. I couldn't bring myself to do it. I'm sorry.
And I'm not. There's no kind of deal where we can do it anyway. You know, I know.
Yeah, I know. I know what you're saying. But I just could not bring myself to. No, I can't. I'm sorry. I'm weak that
way. And North Carolina kind of had that deal for years. They had Jesse Helms as their senator, embarrassing him, and they had people like Jim Hunt and Terry Sanford as governor that did a great job. So, I mean, you know, it has happened.
I can't help me out, Catherine.
Well, I have a hard time, you know, with these rhetorical deals because I think that, well, first of all, if we made that deal, we'd have to have the senator get elected first. And then knowing the way these kind of deals work, we wouldn't get our Democratic senator or Democratic
yeah.
governor. But the other thing is that I think the, you know, and this is not criticizing us, but I think we tend to focus a lot on the Republicans, you know, the Paul Browns and the Tom Prices and the, you know, Johnny Isaacson. Well, he's not so bad. But really what we need to be talking about, or not us in particular, but what needs to be discussed is, okay, so we don't really have anybody that's coming forward that's going to be a good candidate for Senate, as far as I know. I haven't seen any name that is, you know, a slam dunk. And
yeah, either way.
So that means we don't have anyone for governor either. So, you know, in these past years when we've been out of power, we really haven't been doing a very good job. And I will take some credit for this. I think all Democrats who are active have to, you know, sort of, you know, accept that some responsibility. We really have not been building our bench. We really have not.
Right.
You know, we have some young people, some very young, you know, under 35, that are coming up, and they'll be ready at some point. But we really don't. I mean, really, when you look at our bench for someone to run for governor and someone to run for Senate, I mean, I think there's a couple people who are interested in running for governor, but I'm not convinced that they would really be able to do it. But it's not just governor; it's the whole, all the constitutional offices, and it's really, you know, it's just really hard to, you know, those are hard things to accept. Like, we really are not ready, and we've only got 2 years now.
That's right.
Yeah. Catherine, while you were talking, I decided to just look something up real quickly. I tried to find Paul Brown, but it would have been a little bit apples to oranges. But I was able to find Johnny Isaacson and Saxby Chambliss. Now, I just picked one rating. I picked the NEA, which is the National Education Association. Saxby Chambliss rated a 27% from the NEA, which, you know, that's still not great. But Johnny Isaacson only rated a 17. So a lot of times we think these guys, oh, well, they're not so bad. They're worse than the guy we think's bad because they're Republicans and they just vote wrong. So I think we think sometimes the guys
I have a soft spot for Johnny Isaacson because of START, and I admit I have a soft spot for him, and that's, you know, but it's, I mean, he's no prize in my book.
I just remember that race between Bob Barr and what's the flat tax guy, John Linder, and everybody thought, oh, well, Bob Barr is so much worse than John Linder, and when it came right down to it, John Linder was probably worse because he sounded a little more rational, but he was, you know, pushing that flat tax even harder. So I kind of reject that notion of the.
We
the
are in Georgia, though, David, and the Republican Party in Georgia is very conservative. So we have a pretty good idea of what they're going to do when they attain office. That's one reason we're Democrats and don't want them to attain office. But if I've got a choice between Johnny Isaacson and Paul Brown, I'm going to take Isaacson every
time. Me too.
I want each party to select the very best qualified, the person with the best ability as their nominee, and then I want each campaign to be a campaign of ideas, and then the people select the winner. And in the long run, the country's better off like that. Look at how that Cruz guy acted this week. Up there,
Tim, you're segueing into our next topic. Cruz.
Well,
the New York Times has picked up this. Even the Republicans are starting to say that Ted Cruz is, you know, out of control. Now, of course, this guy's going to serve for 6 years.
And you get the idea that if he had tried to run 2 to 4 years later, that he wouldn't have won, or if Paul Sadler would have had more support and people could have, you know, heard the guy we talked with in that interview back in the summer, that Ted Cruz might have had a little bit harder time. But you got to think, some of these Tea Party candidates, they're just going to be out of control. And I agree with you that Paul Brown is probably a less restrained version of Ted Cruz.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it gets into the whole thing where the Republicans have just begun to, you know, savage themselves as they go further and further right. You know, we never really got deep into the thing with Chuck Hagel. I mean, are any Republicans going to say, you know, this guy was a Republican, and this is the president trying to nominate a Republican? Maybe he's not our number one pick, but it's better than, in their eyes, you'd think it would be better than some Democrat. Why are the Republicans not pushing back against these fringe elements of their party?
Because the Tea Party, they think the Tea Party is so powerful. I'm not convinced they are, but I think they think they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it would be like in the Democratic Party, if a guy, you know, showed up in a bicycle and then chastised people for coming in a car. And then if they served, you know, hot dogs, say, why isn't everybody a vegan? And then we could come up with some other stuff. And then, you know, kind of was angry at people because they weren't pure enough left. We'd probably say, hey, you're never going to win. You know, you're a little too far one way. These Tea Party people are the same way. They're just too far to the right. And their party's not rejecting them. And I just don't understand why. Why they, you know, the what you would think would be the middle of their party has moved so far to the right. Tim,
because of 2010, they saw the power of the Tea Party unharnessed, unshackled at the polls, and it swept them to victory. And the leadership in Congress, mistakenly, I believe, thought that they could control them, whip them into line, and that's just not happening. Cruz is proud of what he's doing. He's saying, hey, this is what I'm elected to do. Come up here and create havoc, get myself known, speak out against some things, and vote against everything in sight, which he has. He was one of three senators that voted against Kerry. He voted against relief for Sandy. He's voting against everything. That's the way this new bunch is, and that's the way they're going to act. Now, people say, well, you're just picking on him because he's a Republican. It ain't just Republicans. I realize that. If you think he's bad, go look up Alvin Green. Do I need to say more? You know.
But Alvin Green didn't win, and so that's
thank
the difference.
God.
Yeah.
Thank
we can
God.
Always point to a flake that doesn't win. It's
yeah.
the flake that win that are much more the issue. And you got to think, when are the just the average, you know, Texas voter going to say, we don't want this guy? I mean, you know, Tom mentioned demographics, but when at some point is just the average white Southern voter going to say, this ain't me? I mean, I'm not this right wing.
I think I have an answer there. It's going to be a little while in these midterms for demographics to catch up, because less people vote in midterms and the more conservative voters vote in midterms. And so it's going to take years for demographics to catch up with them to the point that they already are in the presidential race. You follow what I'm saying?
But that's what I'm saying. When are white Southern voters going to say, look, Sandy Hurricane Relief, you voted against it. I mean, who in America is really against that? I mean, if you did a poll, and I'm sure there's been a poll done, it's probably like 90% for, 10% against.
I think you'd be surprised at those numbers. I don't think they would be that sure.
80-20. I mean, still, these guys are not with their average constituent. And for that matter, Ted Cruz, I guess you wouldn't say even is the average white male, because he's not white, he's Hispanic. But he's not
even American, he's Canadian. He wasn't born in
Canadian.
This country.
I know, well,
You know, the Hispanic Canadians serving in our country, all one of them. Yeah. Well, guys, next Sunday is Oscar Sunday, and we didn't even get to Argo. Maybe we'll definitely put that on the list for next week with it being the Oscar Sunday. But until then, it's been the Kudzu Vine.
Great. Good night, guys.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for